Well, as we've been hearing, a woman in the east of the country who travelled here from northern Italy has been confirmed as the second case of coronavirus in Ireland. The Department of Health has said it was notified last night of the new case, and the process of tracing contacts and notifying those contacts has begun. In a moment, we'll be speaking about some of the travel implications that remain as we attempt to contain the spread of COVID-19. But first, I'm joined on the line from Trinity College, Dublin, by Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology, and Dr. Sarah Doyle, HSE consultant in public health. Dr. Doyle, when do you expect that all the contact tracing might be completed in relation to the second case announced last night?
Okay, well, it's difficult to give a categoric answer to that, Sean, and I'm not privy to the immediate circumstances of that case, but I know from my own experience that this will involve a detailed interview with the case. She will be asked about all the places that she has been and the people with whom she has been in contact while she has had symptoms. And then the process will start to make contact with those people and give them the appropriate information, advice. And they're all categorised depending on the level of risk for them. And so, yes. For example, household contacts would obviously be the initial ones.
And this obviously is a situation that changes perhaps hour to hour and day to day, most certainly. So at what point do the health authorities here, Dr. Doyle, consider the idea of going, say, from containment to mitigation?
Okay, well, so we would go from containment to mitigation when... For example, when we're not containing it, now to be sort of a little bit obvious. So you have a case, you're identifying contacts, you're tracking them down. But if it becomes apparent, if a case popped up, let's say elsewhere, sorry for the use of that term, but if there was a case in the West, for example, and that person hadn't travelled from an affected area, for example, that would indicate. So if we had a number of those, or if there were a number of cases being identified through the contact tracing that went beyond the immediate contact. So we call them generations of cases. So you've got your first generation and then the next case that goes on from that, that's the next generation. So if you can imagine, so containment is about, if we go back a week and we had no cases in Ireland and we're looking at, there's sustained transmission in Italy. Now, up until relatively recently, we didn't know that. So people went to Italy on their holidays and they came home and totally, not through no fault of their own, they were exposed to people there. They came home. The advice we're giving to everybody still is if you've travelled from an affected area and you develop symptoms within 14 days, you need to make contact with us. So these people made contact and then they're considered to be a suspect case. And so if you can imagine then, what we do is we advise the infection prevention measures to prevent any further transmission. Then what we do is we do the detailed interview, we identify contacts, we categorise them depending on their level of risk, and then they're given advice depending on their level of risk. And so therefore we're trying to just limit the spread.
Now, the department said last night that ambulance crews would be carrying out testing. How can crews that already are at the pin of their collar manage these kind of assignments?
Well, in a detailed policy and agreement has been developed around that. And I suppose just to say, this is a really, really important situation that is developing and evolving in our country. So we're going to need to start to think slightly differently about how we do things. All of us, generally, within, the public, in our workplaces, schools, public spaces, but also within the healthcare services. As we, grapple to deal with this, the healthcare services are going to need to be and are looking at different ways in which they can manage patients and prioritise.
Yes, and if I could turn now to Dr. Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at Trinity College Dublin. So far, so good, up to a point, I suppose you might say. 300 people tested, two positive tests. If it stays like this, do you think we can successfully contain this virus if we just keep what we're doing?
Good morning, Sean. Yes, I think it's good news that we only have 3 cases on the island of Ireland, and all of these are what we call imported cases. We have no evidence of local transmission yet, and that's very good news in that the procedures we have in place are preventing local spread. But I do think that given the fact that all those 3 cases were from people who had travelled to northern Italy, that we do now need to look at more stringent measures for curtailing travel to those regions. I know that the Department of Health have said that non-essential travel could take place, and that's sort of a welcome development, but I think maybe that needs to go a little bit further and try and restrict further travel to those regions that are clearly the centre of the problem.
And in what way? I mean, do you think flights should be banned or the airline should be asked not to go there or what?
Well, I know the airlines already have reduced their number of flights because simply people are not turning up for their flights. They're deciding not to travel, and that's a sensible approach. But I think perhaps one needs to consider more stringent measures of trying to. I mean, it's one thing saying don't travel; it's not essential. But what's essential, and how does an individual judge that? And I think that's the conversation that needs to be had now as to whether a significant number of flights are still going out to northern Italy, and should they be going there is the question I'm asking. That question needs to be discussed.
In relation to hand washing, are you satisfied with the main emphasis or the extent of the emphasis that's been put on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think hand washing is one way of stopping if somebody, coughs and sneezes and they open a door with their hand. That's one potential way of transmitting. But by far the most likely way of transmitting is through somebody sneezing or coughing in the vicinity of where you're sitting or standing. So that's the biggest risk. So coming in contact with somebody who's infected and coughing or sneezing. So the hand washing will mitigate against stopping somebody who has, contaminated the surface, and then you won't get it picking up. But there's a false sense of security, and if I wash my hands, I'll be okay, because it doesn't stop you getting infected if somebody who is infected comes in contact with you.
And the idea of this, it seems to be the wisdom we're getting is that if you're sitting, you need to be sitting beside somebody for 15 minutes before you should be concerned.
I'm very surprised with that figure. I don't know where it came from. I think that if you're sitting beside someone and they sneeze in your face for 10 seconds, you can get infected, in my view. So I think the 15 minutes is a figure that has now sort of crept into to this. And while it is for certain, the longer you're in contact with somebody who's infected, the greater your risks of getting infected. But I would say that the 15 minutes is a very arbitrary figure.
Okay, stay with us if you can. I want to go briefly now, because Ian Renton is very much under pressure of time. He is on the line. He's regional director of the Jockey Club in charge of Cheltenham Racecourse. Ian, what kind of precautions? As of now, the meeting is going ahead, and obviously a lot of Irish people in their tens of thousands will be glad to hear that, as well as English people as well. Next Tuesday is the off. The Cheltenham Roar will go up, where everybody is hoping. It's still all systems go, but what kind of precautions, extra precautions, are being taken?
Yes, we obviously absolutely look forward to welcoming many Irish over here next week. And we are upping the precautions wherever we can in terms of increasing the number of restrooms and wash hand basins available to the public, having availability of antiseptic gel, and communicating with all our visitors in advance to ensure they follow the government guidelines in terms of self-isolation in the event they've been to affected countries and are carrying any symptoms.
So plenty of soap and water and hand gel. But what about the fact that, cash, a lot of it changes hands now? I mean, will it be possible for people to do contactless betting, for instance?
There is the ability to contactless betting, and particularly through the Toton course, that is an option. So yes, we will certainly be promoting that as well.
And are you concerned, though, that a lot of people might stay away just because they want to be careful? They think the best way to avoid getting coronavirus or COVID-19, as it's called, is to avoid crowds.
I think there is a danger that certain people, and we've already been in touch with a fair few people particularly the elderly or slightly unwell, who have been advised by their doctors not to travel or not to attend, so that there is a danger there, and I think, you know, that's a very sensible precaution people will be taking. But you know, the message from our government over here, and I'm sure probably likewise for you, is that you know, the country should continue with business as usual for as long as possible. And I think, you know, that is the message we're receiving from the government. They want the country to continue operating, even though at some stage in weeks or months to come, there may have to be additional restrictions brought in.
Somewhere in the back of your mind, though, I'm wondering if there's a niggling doubt that the guidelines could change, the festival could still be called off. That could be the advice.
That is always a possibility, and you know, we never can give a cast iron guarantee that, you know, even if it's not this, that something else won't come to bite us. But that's certainly the messaging we have received, is that it is highly unlikely that the message that was given out by a government yesterday is going to change in time to affect the festival.
This might seem like an off-the-wall suggestion, but would it be completely out of the question to have a race meeting, a bit like happens in some football matches, going on behind closed doors? In other words, the races would go ahead, but the stands would be empty.
I think we look at every conceivable option, and as you would imagine, I mean, last year we had the high winds potentially affecting us during the meeting, and we're looking at options if we were to lose a day. But at the moment, we're absolutely full steam ahead, preparing for four fantastic days racing and 250,000 people visiting us.
Okay, Ian Renton, Regional Director of the Jockey Club in charge of the Cheltenham Racecourse. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. I'm joined also in studio now by Ida Millen, author of, I hesitate to use the name of your book, Ida, but it is called Stacking the Coffins: Influenza, War and Revolution in Ireland, 1918 to 1919. You're a historian of disease in Carlow College. Is there any remote connection between what we're going through now and the subject of your book?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for a start, they're both part of the coronavirus family. Flu is spread in a slightly different way. I understand from talking to virologist friends that it comes through a fine mist and a spray, as well as the coughs and sneezes, and can linger in a room for maybe 24 hours, whereas this one is big droplet. We're all kind of well aware of this by now, I suppose. And the idea of coughing in your face is definitely something.
Yes, but we must have learned a great deal over the last century about minimising the risks.
Yes, I think what's fascinating about the then and now approach is to look at what we've learned in terms of public health and medicine and medical science in the last 100 years, and see how we're going to manage this and how successful we will be compared to this pandemic and the other three pandemics we've had in between.
Yes, talk us through them. We go back, say, a century, the Spanish flu, I mean, which actually killed more people than the First World War.
Yeah, the Spanish flu killed upwards of 50 million people, 22 million now, we know now, in India alone. So it's somewhere maybe about 100 million, possibly, as a rough hand guide, but you know, statistics and death certification.
And in Ireland?
23,000, including the excess pneumonia deaths. And I estimate that it had infected, if it had a case fatality rate of 2.5%, about 800,000 people.
Right.
So that's about one-fifth of the population. And that's broadly in line with what epidemiologists are suggesting this might infect in the next year.
Yeah, so, but if we've learned so much and medicine has improved, and so, I mean, surely you're not, it would, the damage or the casualties and the deaths, the mortality rate would be far lower.
Yeah, well, what's all the management so far would suggest that the mortality rate will be lower, because we hope it won't infect as many people. And that's the point of all this hand washing, is to stop it infecting as many people, or to slow down the infection.
So that was the Spanish flu, and then you come on then another 40 years later, you had the Asian flu in the 50s.
Yeah, in 57, and that killed about a million people globally, so it's much less. And then, of course, by then you have antibiotics introduced, which means the secondary pneumonias and things aren't as much of a problem. And in 68 then we have the Hong Kong flu, and that kills about 700,000 globally.
Right, and then we had the swine flu, I think, was the most recent iteration.
Yeah, in 2009, yeah. So that breaks out in Mexico City, and of course it places the Mexican tourism industry under major threat.
Yeah. Scientists often say we don't know how bad this outbreak will be until it's over. It's a bit like weather forecasters saying we don't know how bad this storm will be until it's over. It's very frustrating, though, for people to hear.
Yes. And if you look at the WHO and indeed the HSE guidance on how to calculate case fatality rates, it is very interesting because we don't have the total numbers yet and we're not counting in exact chronological order. So you can't say, you know, if you start having cases that appear on Tuesday and you have deaths on Wednesday, you know, over the course of a month, like how do you calculate, or over the course of 2 months as we have now? It's very hard to say. We won't know until it's over how many have died. For example, with the my pandemic, as I call it, the 1918 pandemic, there were three waves. And most of the deaths were concentrated into those three waves over the course of 10 months.
But there was complacency, I think, set in, certainly in the UK, that when the first wave had passed, is that people kind of relaxed, not bearing sufficiently in mind or knowing that there would be other waves.
Yes, absolutely. And this is really evident through the newspapers here as well and in the UK and globally. And that's one of the issues I have with people saying, oh, don't panic, we shouldn't panic. If you panic and you get people to wash their hands and we stop the spread of the disease, I think that's a good thing. I think the word panic is actually being misused because panic, hand washing, stocking up on your medicines for a few weeks, that's rational. You know, it's sensible behaviour.
Yeah.
So I think public health should be interested in a little bit of panic as well.
Okay. I just want to go back to Kingston and Sarah. Kingston, the rugby match, as we know, has been called off this weekend. But there will presumably still be a lot of people arriving in Dublin from Italy, north, south and elsewhere this coming weekend. Is there anything that needs to be done?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the obvious risk that people would have bought their tickets and booked their hotels and they might just decide to come to Dublin for the weekend holiday anyway. And, you know, the risks are not as great as congregating in a stadium with 55,000 people. So I think the authorities were absolutely right in putting that match off. But the risks of people from northern Italy, where rugby in Italy is concentrated, still exists because those people will be going to bars and restaurants and staying in hotels, so there will be lots of contact. So there's still risks from people coming from that infected region. It is the most infected region outside of in Europe. So there's still a risk if those people travel.
Is there a case for maybe the government through diplomatic channels? And I know Simon Coveney, the Taoiseach Minister for Foreign Affairs, was expressing the government's sympathy and condolences with the now 70 plus deaths in Italy, but they would maybe ask the Italian government to ask its citizens just not to travel here.
I think that might be a very good idea.
What do you say, Dr. Sarah Doyle, as a public health consultant?
Well, I think in addition to that, I mean, the advice is the same for somebody who travels from Italy, whether they're Italian or whether they're Irish or wherever they have, you know, wherever they're originally from. If they've travelled from northern Italy, we're asking them that if they develop symptoms, that they go into a room with a phone and that they phone a GP or an emergency department. And that advice is being given at the airport. There's a lot of signage. There are personnel there to advise people of that. So if our feeling is that if they have no symptoms, or our advice is that if they have no symptoms, they may still circulate and socialise as usual. But if they develop symptoms, we're asking them to remove themselves and to phone, and then they will have an assessment to determine whether they may have COVID-19. So that's the strategy that we have been employing.
Ida, you wanted to come back in on that point.
Yeah, just to come back to 1918 again, during the peak weeks of the second wave of the flu in November 1918, we had the end of the war, and there was a definite spike in the deaths when people came out to celebrate the end of the war. You know, about a week later, you can see a spike in the deaths.
And do you sort of draw a line from that congregation of public out celebrating then to looking ahead to the St. Patrick's Day celebrations
here?
Yes,
I think so. I think, although people say that this disease dies out in the open air, you know, I think we need to be careful. You also have to think of the Irish tradition of drinking at such occasions, and that if you pick up glasses, maybe that haven't been properly disinfected or something like that too.
Do you think the government should call off effectively the Patrick's Day events?
It's a hard call because it affects economics as well, and it's a big call to make.
Yeah, but to give you back your own words.
I think it would be sensible to do it.
You do. And again, come back a little more on the, you know, you say we shouldn't be afraid of the word panic, but I mean, panic surely is not a good idea ever in any situation. I mean, you've got to be rational about things. Panic means you lose control.
Yes, I think we're using the wrong word, and you hear, public advice about not panicking. You know, there's rational fear and preparation. I'm trying to think of a word that would be more appropriate.
Vigilance,
yeah. Preparedness.
Yes. So again, what is going to, what might swing it, coming back to yourself, Dr. Sarah Doyle, public health consultant, what would make the government and colleagues like yourself who advise government to take a different view of something like St. Patrick's Day?
Okay, so just to sort of, we have to think all the time about, you know, how the virus is spread, and we've talked about that, and we've talked about containment and about the fact that in Ireland at the moment, we've had, we've had 3 imported cases. There is no evidence that we have sustained community transmission. And you asked me earlier about, you know, the move from containment to mitigation. So, you know, it's reasonable to stay in containment, you know, if there's sort of limited numbers of introductions, and if we can stay on top of the contact tracing and we can limit the spread. But if there, if we move to a situation where there's kind of widespread, where the virus is clearly circulating within the community, and I started to describe earlier, you know, if there was one case in Galway with no travel history and then another somewhere else and then a few cropping up, you know, in another place. So When we move to a phase where there is evidence of sustained community transmission, then we need to move to a phase of mitigation.
Right. So it's a very... Sorry, go ahead, finish, yeah?
No, I was just going to say, and so the messaging, then, you know, will be, you know, much, much firmer in terms of... I mean, at that stage, we will be saying to anybody who is sick, even mildly sick, to stay at home and to self-isolate. The message about washing hands is absolutely critical, and people will need to start to think about, where they're circulating. Like, I'm at home, and when I go out of my home in the morning, you know, I wash my hands before I go into work and I circulate with others. I wash my hands when I leave, when I go on a break. You know, thinking about when I'm on my own and with my own germs, or with my family and my family's germs, or when you're going on to public transport. So we need to start thinking much more, in a much more detailed way, within workplaces and schools and public spaces about how the virus is spread and how we will be able to contain it, because there's no such thing as no risk, but there is kind of minimizing risk, and actually the only way we're going to protect ourselves is actually by protecting others.
Well, look, thank you very much indeed for bringing us those insights. Dr. Sarah Doyle, a public health consultant, and also my thanks as well to Professor Kingston Mills. We'll let you go now and talk briefly to Paul Bell, Health Division Organiser with SIP2. Paul, good morning to you. Chief Medical Officer Tony Holohan announced last night ambulance personnel would now be performing some coronavirus tests rather than having people go to hospital for tests. Are you confident, Paul, that there will be, or that there are enough ambulance personnel to do that as well as your normal duties?
Well, first of all, SIP2 ambulance professionals, Sean, from all ranks, from management to frontline staff, have responded to ambulance management's call through an expression of interest to volunteer or to perform this particular duty. And air members are determined to stand up as a frontline service to defend the public and defend the health of the public. So in response to your question, following engaging with national management, we are confident that there will be enough resources, first of all, to perform these tests. Our members are being trained up in the requirements and the protocol. They're also being equipped with the protective clothing. And on top of that, then, with the additional hours, we are confident at this stage that ambulance calls of an emergency nature will continue to be responded to in the normal way.
Right. Well, Paul, thank you very much indeed for that. I'm joined now as well by travel writer Fionn Davenport. Fionn, I gather you're just back in the UK from Orlando, Florida. You witnessed fellow passengers' behaviour on the flight. What kind of things were happening?
I did, Sean. So for the very first time in my life, and that's tens of thousands of flights maybe, I saw every passenger around me using antibacterial liquids and sprays to wipe down every surface of their seat, the chair itself, the tray table, the video screen in front of them, and meticulously doing so, which actually struck me as profoundly, I won't say odd, because given the context of what is happening, but I've never, ever seen that happen before.
Yeah, and did you do it yourself?
I did. I think because these are the precautions that are being taken about washing your hands and using an anti-bac. So I have to admit, it's the very first time I've ever done it. But it's something that is much more common. Even in the queue for the security, I noticed there was a lot of young people traveling, I don't know to where, but a substantial number of them were wearing face masks. And again, that struck me as perhaps, well, I'm not a virologist or an immunologist, but it struck me as like a tad overcautious. But yeah, having said that, it certainly, there's a different atmosphere, definitely, and travel than anything I've witnessed before.
You also spoke to ground staff and flight attendants. Now, what kind of concerns were they sharing with you?
Well, one of them was in terms of flight load. So that my own flight, I was told, was a third emptier than would be normal for this time of year. And given that travel to Orlando is incredibly popular around this time, so that obviously is a concern for theirs. And then the ground staff manager, just idle chat with him, he suggested that he wouldn't be surprised if all international flights into the United States were cancelled by the end of the week. Now, I hasten to add that he doesn't know whether that's true or not. He has no inside knowledge. He has no information. But what it's, because, and I put it to him, I says, like, how can you know that? And he goes, oh, no, I don't. But I would not be surprised if that were the case. And that says to me is that it speaks to the level of concerns and lack of knowledge, particularly in the US, because one of the things I've noticed over the last few weeks is that there's been very little talk about COVID-19 or the coronavirus, and what talk there has been couched in very political terms. So you have the administration who are using terms about closing borders and the potential of it, and also is to minimize the risk. And infamously, we heard Donald Trump last week compared to sort of, it's just like the flu. So what I notice is that the United States has been playing catch up, in part because it has very few cases. There was the third case in Florida was announced the day I left. But generally speaking, there's been very, very few cases. And so perhaps that speaks to the I won't say that they're behind the curve, but they're certainly, it's not as big an impact as it is in Europe.
Yeah. Fionn, what about flights? And I know we've heard Ryanair, for instance, talk about reducing by 25% on some routes. But I just got a text from a friend earlier on. He was saying he was trying to book flights to Milan from Dublin for later this month on his app. And he said it's showing all Milan flights between the 11th and 8th, of March and the 8th of April sold out. The standard Rome fare has trebled over the exact same period. And he just wondered, you know, why would that be so?
Because, well, that doesn't surprise me at all. One is because, as you said, Ryanair have cancelled 25% of their flights to Italy up to and including, I think, the 8th of April. British Airways have done the same. I would imagine that most airlines flying into Italy will have reduced their capacity. And when you reduce capacity, the price of existing flights will automatically go up. And airlines are taking a very kind of interesting approach to all of this. On the one hand, a lot of airlines have cancelled change fees. So normally when you want to change your flight, unless you bought like the super expensive one, you have to pay X amount, usually anywhere from 50 to 100 euro to change your flight. So a lot of the airlines have cancelled this change fee.
Yes.
But equally, at the same time, they're in the business of trying to safeguard their businesses. And when you have for example, IATA, so the International Air Transport Association, are reporting that some airlines, including one of the biggest carriers in Europe, as yet unnamed, is reporting falls in flight bookings of 108%, but also many carriers are reporting a 50% no-show across several markets. Now, that is incredibly worrying for the airline industry, in that when you have all these, so as a result, the flights that are available, I wouldn't be surprised if that they were priced as high as they are. And I mean, your friend says, what, triple the price? That seems excessive, but to see them more expensive than normal would not surprise me at all.
Okay, Fionn, thank you very much for joining us. And back briefly and finally to yourself, Ida Milne, historian of disease in Carlow College. What more do you think needs to be done by the authorities?
Oh, I think they could probably be at this stage training up the civil defence and various maybe local voluntary groups to do testing and maybe home nursing and things like that as well. We could all be doing a lot more to hand wash. I go in with a big pack of hand wipes into my lecture halls in Carlow College, which incidentally is very well prepared with lots of hand sanitizers. But I do it in front of the students because they're not seeing it as a big problem because it's not hitting their age group. But I go in and remind them it could affect me and it could affect their parents and grandparents.
Okay, well look, Ida, thank you so much indeed for coming. That's Ida Milne there, and my thanks as well to our other contributors. We'll have more on the programme just after this short break.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.